Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Dwight Golan, thank you for taking the time to speak a little bit about what we're going to talk about today, which is how to spin a mediator or how to manipulate a mediator, or maybe a little bit about how to train a mediator as well. Okay, so let's start about very interesting an article that you or video actually you've done for the ABA and an article that you've written for the a litigation magazine on basically how to use effectively the mediator if you're a litigation lawyer or a party in a mediation.
Well, I call it how to borrow a mediator's powers, because I think mediators do have powers, not the one to decide a case, right, but a lot of more subtle powers over the process. And I find that lawyers who have a feel for what those powers can be will take the initiative to use them or to ask me to use them. They get better off results.
But before we get there, though, let's talk a little bit about your background, because, you know, let's put aside modesty for a second.
Okay.
So we say you are one of the big names in mediation, one of the people
I'm one of the familiar names in mediation.
Let's say one of the familiar names in mediation. Let's not provoke any unnecessary conflict with others out there.
Yep.
But you're well-known in mediation. A little background about where you came from and what led you down this path.
I was a litigator for 15 years in a private firm and then with the state attorney general in Massachusetts. And I thought of myself as a trial lawyer, tried dozens of cases to juries, became somewhat frustrated with the amount of time and effort that the trials took up, and the feeling that often judges, since I was in a regulatory mode, couldn't give me the kind of relief I wanted at the end of the trial anyway. It became to seem as if it would be more and more useful to try to find alternatives, given that most of the cases settled anyway. And particularly in government practice, you don't have any incentive to keep a case going. You want to get to a resolution as quickly as you can. So after I started law teaching, I began to teach dispute resolution, and then I began to do it. And then I began to train people to do it. And for the last almost 20 years now, have been either training or teaching or doing commercial dispute resolution. Not community-based so much, and not marital or family, but legal disputes, usually business, but also including employment, construction, IP and others.
And whereabouts? Geographically, you mainly focus in the Northeast, or it would be domestically, nationally, or also international?
They are mostly focused, the actual mediations are mostly focused in the Northeast.
Okay.
There will be international parties, but they will be parties who have somehow been drawn into the American litigation system.
Right.
For the training, it's all over the place. There was a period of time when Europeans wanted training. Now they have their own mediator trainers.
Right. Yeah.
So for couple of years, the past 3 years, I've gone for CPR to China to train commercial arbitrators as part of their new effort to establish commercial mediation in China. I'm not sure how successful that has been yet, but you have to start somewhere.
It takes time.
It's a cultural shift.
Right. Yeah.
It's a cultural shift.
Well, so before we get into training mediators, let's get back to, for a moment, spinning mediators.
Fine.
I mean, that conjures up a wonderful image of a mediator spinning around. Tell us about spinning the mediator or using the powers of the mediator effectively. Why do you think there's a need for this?
I think too many lawyers go into mediation and treat it almost as if they were going to have a fight, but the mediator was their boxing gloves, so they couldn't hurt each other too much. And they use the mediator to kind of modulate the anger that comes out, which is all right. Some of them seem to just use mediators as telephones, back and forth and back and forth, while they bargain pretty much the way they did before. And a few treat it almost like going into surgery. They get a good surgeon, they go under the anesthetic, and they hope they come out with the right, leg fixed. I think mediators have power.
Yeah.
And I think that the lawyers who know how appropriately to ask a mediator to use their power get better results.
You didn't mention one of the things that I've seen, probably because in the U.S., the profession, or the, let's say, the mediation, as it's practiced, the practice of mediation is rather more advanced in many other places. One thing that I still see every now and then is, and this is outside the U.S., is parties counsel pitching cases to the mediator as if the mediator were the decision maker.
Oh, they do that. I think that's because they're used to arbitrators and judges.
Right, right.
Sometimes it even makes sense. If you're accusing the other side of fraud, let's say, it's easier to tell the mediator that than to look the other side in the eye and call them thieves. But I let that happen. I figure that's an early stage in the process, and they have to talk to me. Ideally, by some point in the process, they start talking to each other, or we set up little side meetings where people talk. And if that can happen, that's a good process. A lot of the time they stay separated in their separate rooms, and I shuttle back and forth, or any mediator would.
Right. So now tell us, now, how do we spin the mediator? How do we use the powers effectively?
I think mediators have various powers. The first part is credibility. We're just not, you, if you're a mediator, are not subject to reactive devaluation, the attitude that if he proposes it, it can't be any good
idea
for me.
Right.
I can propose exactly the same thing that you would, and they'll listen to me, partly because they want to be polite, but also because genuinely it's not viewed the same way. And so I see good lawyers trying to get me to basically take responsibility for ideas that they're okay with. I can't take responsibility for something the other side will see as biased, because if I do, they'll see me as having been seduced by you. But within limits, I can do it. Another thing I can do
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. The trickiest part, because people suspect each other so much when they're in litigation, is anything that involves a future relationship. There will be a fair number of what I call too expensive to get divorced kind of cases. The parties, by the time they sued each other, would really rather go away, but they can't afford it. There isn't enough money. So we have to put them back together in some way. But if they propose it, immediately the other side reacts angrily, suspiciously, etc. If they get me to propose it, I might be viewed as naive, I really don't understand how bad the other side is, and so forth. But I can kind of be a marriage broker a little bit when either they want to, or more likely they have to, somehow find a way to patch it up. That would be an example. Floating possibilities of, you know, restructured loans and payment over time. If they propose payment over time, it's viewed as a way to welch out of the debt. If I propose it, they want to know what the interest rate's going to be and what the security is going to be.
So you would find out from one of the parties what might be acceptable to them.
Yeah.
And then reach across to the other side.
Well, I do that anyway. Yeah. But smart lawyers anticipate me. And if they think that this is a way of getting it done, sometimes they'll even catch me out in the hallway saying, you know, I've got a problem with my client. He's really not ready to think about this yet. But I think it's got to go this way. It's the only way we're going to get it done. And if I'm a smart mediator, I listen to the lawyer, because he or she knows a lot more about the parties and the case than I do.
Right.
And good lawyers will catch me in the hallway and lobby me a little bit. Or if they have a client problem, they'll tell me what they think. For instance, they want me to give an evaluation because their client has to hear it, and they don't want to be the ones to deliver the bad news. And they can sit there and look skeptical and, gee, I don't know, Dwight, I think it's a better case than that. But the fact is, they know there are problems with the case, and I know what they're doing, and it's okay. It's a way of, it's part of client management.
Are there other powers of mediators?
I think mediators within limits decide what gets discussed. So if you want causation discussed or you want damages not discussed, within limits you can tell the mediator that this wouldn't be a good time to focus on punitive damages. And within limits, the mediator is less likely to get out of punitive damages if you tell him that than if he's blundering around trying to figure out what's going on. Another level is mediators control process. I've had situations where I tell somebody, look, we're going to have discussion on three levels. One is going to be about the merits. Another one is trading money offers back and forth, because we have to do that. And a third level is, let's talk about whether or not some modification of the relationship might be another option, or whether there are things you want in addition to money. And if you raise them, particularly if you're a plaintiff, the defendant will assume, well, if I give him that, I won't have to give him money. If I raise it, it's understood that it's a two-level discussion. And smart plaintiffs understand that, and they try to prompt me to do it.
So if you're not a good mediator, but if you're a good lawyer in a mediation, you want to find those powers of the mediator and use them effectively and make sure that they're used beneficially.
Right. You, for you,
For the party. I'm a party.
Right. You're using it for yourself. You can't ask me to do something that will that I think will backfire or that I think will force me to take sides or even be seen as taking sides because I see that as destroying my effectiveness from that point on. But there are a lot of things you can ask. You can ask me for information. I'm the one who's in the other caucus room and sees what's going on. I won't tell you that there's a fight between the lawyer and client, but if you ask me, is the client still as angry as he was, you know, during the opening session, or do you think he's now ready to listen to a compromise, within limits, I see it as part of my job and appropriate to tell you that.
And do you see lawyers making a big difference for their clients in mediation, those who know how to use the powers of a mediator effectively and those who perhaps are just traditional litigators who find themselves in mediation?
I'm
asking fairly. Does it make a difference in the end if someone can use the mediator effectively?
Sure. I'm surprised how few lawyers do it. I think lawyers basically use the same kind of bargaining that they would use in a direct negotiation and rely on the mediator to make it work better. And the good ones, they feel, will make it work better faster than the bad ones.
So you're saying in most cases there may be a lot of value being left on the table because they're not taking advantage of the process.
Yeah. And I'm not saying 30% value, but if you could add 10 or 15% value,
sure. Yeah.
That becomes the critical gap that you finally close. I think it happened. The other area where I see it is where there are serious emotional difficulties, and the lawyers don't feel comfortable getting involved with their clients on a very personal or emotional level. And I've had lawyers who will tell me about that ahead of time and suggest I meet with their client ahead of time. And it's almost always okay with the other side as long as I tell the other side. And we start processing some of the emotion stuff before we get to the mediation itself. Otherwise, you're often asking for too much emotional adjustment from a client in one day or even 2 days, and you can't get it done. Or I've had even, this is trickier for a mediator, but I remember one in which a lawyer basically said to me he couldn't talk to his client anymore. He was really busy with other places. She was absolutely impossible to deal with. And would I go talk to her and explain to her why this was a good settlement? And I thought it was a good settlement. And I did talk to her. And I've had breakfast with people. And I've had I've gone out and seen people in their shops and basements and whatever. But it's and I'll do it if I see it needed. But lawyers will often know what the emotional problems are in a case better than I do because they've lived with it for 3 years and because their client especially knew the people on the other side. I do very few pure personal injury cases. Almost all of them arise from some kind of relationship. And so the people who are in that relationship, if they think about it, can often tell me whether there's some hidden barrier, somebody's asking their cousin for advice, that sort of thing.
Well, thanks. Turning the page from using a mediator effectively to training mediators, I'd be grateful if you could tell us a little bit about your experiences teaching mediation, teaching people to become mediators. You've taught for CPR, I think, and the government, and as you mentioned, you taught it in China. What's the reference point when you teach mediation? What are the principles?
The first reference point is how much time you have. I'm struck by the fact that we teach people to be mediators in enormously less time than if we were trying to teach them to play tennis, go skiing. Right. My wife is a yoga instructor. She had to take 500 hours of training to teach people to do down dogs. I got 35 hours of training to do complex commercial mediation. Now, either you have to assume I already knew how to do it and just needed a few finishing touches, or we are seriously undertrained.
Okay.
And I think some of the foreign programs do a better job than the American programs, maybe because you folks are more into regulation and careful structure. I don't know.
Maybe a respect for structure. It may be. Well, first of all, I don't know that there is more because I often have difficulty finding mediators who've been or people who hold themselves out who've received training in mediation. That's the only criteria. To get to mediation, I often let the other side pick the mediator to say, we would like to try mediation. You go ahead and choose somebody. On one condition, it has to be a real mediator.
Right.
You have to have taken it. And I'm liberal with this because we're trying to get to mediation to say, tell me if it's CPR, or it could be CEDAR, or it could be a local, bar association even training where they've got the basic principles. But so I guess my question is more directed at what are the standards? What are the reference points being used when you teach mediation?
If I'm teaching it, and I'm almost always I'm teaching it to lawyers, I'm trying to get them to use the skills they already have, but in a different context.
Right.
To be analytic, but not to say it immediately. To learn how to run a process that lets people negotiate within some freedom, and to have some sensitivity to emotional issues, which often lawyers find very difficult to deal with. If I can do those three things in the space of 4 days, it's a pretty good training. I and the people I train with almost all rely heavily on role-playing, because it's like trying to learn golf or tennis or anything. If you don't get out on the golf course,
right,
and you just read a book, you're not going to... And I'm just finishing a book on mediation, but I don't kid myself that that's enough. It isn't. And it's much more important to actually role-play a bit. We show video. I videotaped lawyers and mediators just interacting without scripts, and I clip parts of it that I think show good mediator interventions, and so they can sort of see what a pro does. People have enormously different capabilities for it. Partly that's, I suppose, because I train so many former judges and retiring lawyers who are already in their 60s or 70s, and, you know, they have a style.
Right.
And some of them can adapt quite easily, and some of them, it's pretty much like a settlement session, I guess, in a court, and always will be.
Yeah. No, unfortunately, I have to say I've been in some of those.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. And in the right case, maybe that's what they need.
But sometimes it might, but it's not when you, I think when you're signing up for mediation, and it may be that that's the expectation of the party that's not been through mediation before, that they do want a judge, really, not a mediator. But those who've been through mediation, I think, are expecting something more in terms of the skills and the capabilities of the person who comes.
Well, I wrote an article last year on what I saw as the evolution of American mediation. When I was a litigator and we were first using mediators, we did look for ex-judges because they were the ones who'd run settlement conferences before, and we assumed that the barrier was the other side didn't understand the case.
Right, yeah.
So by the mid-90s, people were basically refusing to use judges on the theory that they were incapable of dealing with the act. And since then, I began training ex-judges for JAMS. You know, they can be trained. Yeah. They have, many of them got elected to judgeships, so they have some political skills.
Yeah.
You know, they can learn within limits. Well, I once wrote an article called "Why Is It Hard with My Wife? Why Is It Hard for Lawyers to Deal with Emotional Issues?" which was a dialogue between a lawyer and a psychologist. I mean, there are limits. I'm never going to be a psychologist.
Do you see any trends in training in mediation these days? Of things moving towards, you know, a particular standard?
Well, I think people in America, the training has long been dominated by community mediation groups who treat only interest-based processes, believe only in facilitation, and think evaluation is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a little like sex in the public schools. No one teaches it, and yet you have a sense it's probably going on.
Yes.
And so I worry about programs that don't teach people how to evaluate well, and don't teach people that most of commercial mediation involves money and arguing over the merits of cases.
That's,
I mean,
true.
I have to tell the community people that they should move their training more toward that.
Yeah, I tell you, when you do get stuck in the commercial cases, if somebody is being, you know, is adamant and they're fixed and they're not moving off their position, it's even for us sometimes, it helps to hear. You know, helps to hear from somebody that you respect and is a third party that.
Right.
And you know it. I mean, you know it already. You know, and not every, you know, you never know how things are going to turn out. But to hear it from somebody else can kind of move things forward.
Right. And people need to understand that evaluation is a spectrum of interventions. Yeah. It's not, I'm now going to tell you what the case is worth. And good ones can do it gradually, the minimal needed to move the settlement bus, gets stuck in a pothole, move it out of the pothole and back on the road. And then it chugs away. A part of what I tell lawyers about evaluation and using mediators is figure out what kind of evaluation you need and ask the mediator to provide it. If you think there's a sticking point, let's say on causation, that's what you want evaluated, not the damages, not the whole case. And good lawyers can understand that and will tell me where the pothole is that needs help. It's another example of lawyers kind of intervening.
Well, it sounds like you're the right person to grab in a hallway. Whether you're in a mediation or you happen to be in a hotel lobby where I grab you for this. And I thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.